C2PR. Number 15A.
We stopped right in the middle of the town of Seoul, and we come now to Seoul as life. And here again, it's a very interesting tone for text interpretation. We still have the main subject of sin and sinlessness in Seoul, and now we come to life on line 11, where she says, to cause suffering as a result of sin is the means of destroying sin. Not a very nice one, but it's a method. And so you can already see that she is approaching the method, that there is a method of overcoming sin through the method of suffering. We know that that is usually the method we like to choose, that we only make real progress through suffering. So she goes on and explains that every supposed pleasure in sin will furnish more than its equivalent of pain. It's really not very fair, huh, that it's more than its equivalent. She's very hard on us. Until belief in material life and sin is destroyed. So we can see that here for the first time she indicates something about the belief. A belief, she hasn't talked about belief up to this point really, and brings out that the belief really has an effect, that beliefs work. If I have a belief in sin, then it works. It works as suffering. So we shouldn't always think that only God works. We very well learn in the textbook that beliefs work also. And even faith, blind faith, works also. And we'll touch on that in the fifth prayer. But here for the first time in regard to cause and effect, she shows that a belief works. If the belief is in sin, then it works and brings suffering. So that goes on until belief in material life and sin is destroyed. We can see that in order to handle sin, we have to handle belief. And that naturally brings us to the point of understanding. What handles belief is understanding. And that is what she says in the next sentence. To reach heaven, the harmony of being, you have again harmony of what? Of being, life. We must understand the divine principle of being. So if we take the pith out of this paragraph, we can see that she is now talking about the question of sin, how to overcome sin, and that there are two methods, the method of suffering and the method of understanding. The method of suffering is actually the method of believing in sin, which resolves the whole thing through suffering until we have suffered enough, and then we give in. Or the method of understanding, which he points out, that we begin to understand the harmony of being. And so we must understand the divine principle of being. because the harmony of being we can only have through understanding the principle of being, because harmony is the idea of principle. So we could see that at this point we can see that sin is destroyed through suffering, but that we really must have understanding, that understanding is being. Like Jesus said, you know, to know God is life eternal. Understanding is being. And it will be very interesting to see in the chapter on prayer how she uses understanding very much as a tone of life. We have learned that is a tone of spirit. Understanding and spirit understanding, a tone of soul. But when it comes to the point what really understanding brings to us, then it's always life. That understanding to know God is life. And we'll see then that here it is a subtone of life. And for the first time this law is indicated, that belief brings suffering, that understanding brings harmony. And later on, in the fifth prayer, it's all about this question of blind faith versus understanding. But she still goes on in the next paragraph in the same tone of life. And interesting enough, again she starts out with, God is love. Can you see, somehow if we would only have a one-dimensional consciousness or a one-dimensional subject, this would irritate us. We have been all on the level of sin and how to handle sin, what is sin, what comes out of sin, and so on. And suddenly she says, God is love. But as we know that second scriptural note, and know that there is always a higher level also at work, that is love and mind, we can at once see here that she again introduces that higher sense in order to help us out of this question of, do we believe or do we understand? Therefore, do we get punished or don't we get punished? Because not everybody knows that they don't understand. This is not an easy thing to know if we believe in something or if we understand something. Actually, with Christian Science, we should know. But here she talks to the very beginner that comes right of a religious sense of things. And so she has to tell him something comforting and say, yes, I know, naturally you don't yet know what understanding is, because that will come much later to show you what understanding is. But she would say, so if you read that belief brings suffering and understanding brings harmony, and you don't know what understanding is, you feel really very bad, because you feel, well, is that my fault that I don't understand? Nobody has taught me that. I went to school 9 years and nobody taught me what life is. In church I didn't learn it, so am I to be blamed for it? Am I therefore going through hell and sin and everything, just because I have not been instructed in science? And so she gives this comforting tone constantly. Your father looks after you. Your father knows what you need. Always that higher authority than the human authority. So she says, God is love. More than this we cannot ask, higher we cannot look, farther we cannot go. You get the tone of the exaltation and fullness of life. And she says, you know, because God is love, your sense of life must be that it is full and full and full. All those terms, more than this, we cannot ask. Higher, we cannot look. Farther, we cannot go. You hear those three terms, more, higher, farther, gives one at once a sense of the fullness of life. That sense of the amplitude of life, where one feels one is within the realm of fullness. Therefore she says, to suppose that God forgives or punishes. Do you hear the tone of love again in here? God is love. God does forgive and does not punish. To suppose that God forgives or punishes sins according to his mercy is thought. Is sought. Or unsought. Is to misunderstand love. And to make prayer a safety valve for wrongdoing. Do you hear the tone? The tone is that after the paragraph before, where she has shown, if you have a belief, you are punished. If you understand, you are okay. You have perfect being. The reader says, but I don't know yet what is understanding. I don't know yet how to understand. Am I lost? Must I therefore go through all those punishments and sufferings and punishments and sufferings? That's not my fault. You know, a mortal really should rebel against punishment and against suffering because he didn't want it. He didn't want, the mortal didn't want to be on this earth to know nothing about God. But there he is. The mortal is just put into this world and left to himself, and he can say, I didn't wish it. Nobody wished that. Nobody gave that to me. I didn't want it. So why should I be punished? And therefore should rebel, so to say, against that he is a sinner and that he is being punished for not knowing something which nobody gave him. So she would know that. She would know that and therefore say, you know, you shouldn't look at it just that way. It's a law, that's quite right. To sin will be punished. To understand God brings harmony. But remember, there is a higher authority. God is love. And God as love is mercy. Is merciful. She brings in that fifth beatitude of life, blessed are the merciful, because they shall obtain mercy. And so shows that therefore we should come out of the Old Testament, out of the law of the Old Testament, like Paul, now like Saul came out to be a Paul, and say, the law doesn't work. The law has no power over me. I am under mercy. I live under grace. I live under that love that only has mercy and only shows mercy. No matter if it's sought or unsought, God still is mercy. So there is no more a hard law of punishment, a hard law where you have the finger and say, well, be careful, you know, if you don't do this and that and so on. That law of love that is merciful is always mercy, no matter what our, if we seek it or if we don't seek it. And so she brings in again that term of understanding. That if we think that God is only love if it is sought, then that is to misunderstand love. So understanding love is always the law of mercy. If you understand that there is love, then the law of mind works for us as mercy. And so we can always fall back on that very fact. The side note is mercy without partiality. I can't quite quote now Shakespeare. I wish I could. The quality of... See, that's what he brought out. That mercy is not strained. It doesn't come to just to those who are goodies or who are seeking it. It just comes. God just can't help being God. And not helping being God, he cannot help being love, and not helping being love, he can't help being merciful to everything. So the law of the Old Testament is superseded by the law of mercy and grace. How did we epitomize this? So we said at the point of life, sin destroys itself through suffering, but we reach heaven through an understanding of God's impartial mercy. So that summarizes those two paragraphs, I guess, pretty well, so that we see sin has within itself the ability to destroy itself through suffering, but instead of the belief in sin, we can have understanding, and so we have to understand God's impartial mercy. Then it frees us from penalty. We go to the next tone. Truth. That again goes over three paragraphs. So little by little we come into that text that comprises many paragraphs. It says, Jesus uncovered and rebuked sin. Again, can you see the tone that goes through it? The main tone is still sin. It's all about sin. Right from the beginning, it's sin, sin and suffering. And so now we come to see how Jesus would handle sin. And Jesus uncovered and rebuked sin before he cast it out. Before he cast it out. The moment we read that, cast out sin, we know we are in the tone of truth. Because truth always casts out error, destroys error, wipes out error, and so on. So the moment we come here to truth, we see it. So how does truth deal with sin? Of a sick woman, he said that Satan had bound her. So that was the uncovering of it, the analysis and uncovery. And to Peter he said, thou art an offense unto me. Again, the offense, tone of sin. He came teaching and showing men how to destroy sin, sickness, and death. And you see again, repeating, on line 23 you had to cast out sin. Now it is 27, to destroy sin, sickness, and death. And on 28 he said to the fruitless trees, it is hewn down. Do you see how we read? We read to listen to the tones. Here a tone is repeated in a few lines three times, always with different words. It is the stone of truth cast out sin, the stone of truth to destroy sin, sickness and death, the stone to hew down the fruitless trees. It's the stone of truth. Is that clear? Very clear. So at once we see this has to do with truth, but at the point of soul, because the subject is how do we deal with sin? And he said, well, Jesus rebuked sin and then cast it out. He goes on and says, it is believed by many that a certain magistrate who lived in the times of Jesus left this record. His rebuke is fearful. Can you see again on 31? You have the rebuke of soul. You had the rebuke of soul on 23. She stays with the tone. But in order to bring out the tone that we rebuke sin through truth, means to rebuke sin through analyzing, uncovering, and destroying error, erroneous beliefs. So she brings that out in various sentences. So his rebuke was fearful, very strong. Who would have liked to be a disciple of Jesus like Peter? And poor Peter tried his best. He just loved Jesus. He would just do anything, anyway he thought he would. And then when he said something very wonderful about Jesus, you know, on the Mount of Vision, and said, you are the big guy, not Elias and Moses. You are the big guy, you know. You really are. Jesus would say to him, get thee behind me, Satan. Would we like that? Would any of you like it if I would say, get thee behind me, Satan? You stand in my way. You try to do something with me that I don't want to do, that is not in my life, that is not in my purpose, that is not in my destiny. We wouldn't like it. And if we say something in a very diluted form compared with Jesus, oh boy, then we really get into trouble. We are not allowed to say the least, but Jesus knew what he was doing. He was a great educator. He could see that tremendous Peter, you know, with all his tremendous zeal, that he could only bend him by giving it right back to him. If he wanted to teach him something, he couldn't teach it with a gentle smile. He had to know that terrific rock had to be shaken really good and bad in order to learn something. So he said, get thee behind me, Satan. And well, this is actually scientific analysis and destruction. The other is just moonbeams on the polar ice. Doesn't melt a thing. So the strong language of our master confirms this description. So when we always come to the point of truth, it's rather strong. And there is a great sense of love in it if one once has to put somebody straight with plain speaking and perhaps with sharp, clear language. There is nothing really unloving about that, if one takes it. Still, the text goes on in the same vein. The only civil sentence which he had for error was, get thee behind me, Satan. Or the other was, thou art an offense unto me. Just as bad. As hard. Still stronger evidence that Jesus' reproof was pointed and pungent. You see, again, reproof. It did never have that term of soul rebuking, reproving, until at the point of soul as truth. And then we had it already twice before, namely Jesus rebuked sin, then his rebuke is fearful, now it is the reproof, his reproof was poignant. Do you see that whenever the tone recurs and recurs, we know that this is the pith of the subject. So we can here easily see that it's all about rebuke and reproof. So he was showing the necessity for such forcible utterance when he cast out devils. Again, you have cast out the tone of truth. And healed the sick and sinning. And then she winds it up all in one sentence and says, therefore, the relinquishment of error deprives material sense, the opposite of soul, that which sins, of its false claims. When material sense has a false claim, it sins. We have sin. Material sense that does not go along with the rule of soul is deviating from it, and that is sin. That's the tone of truth. Again, to repeat it just for the sake of text interpretation, up to this point in the tone of soul, we never had those two terms, those two ideas, not ideas, those two concepts. The first was reproof, and the other was cast out. Now, that reproof comes as rebuke and rebuke and reproof three times, as casting out. We have seen it comes on line 23, then it comes off in 27, destroys sin. Then it comes in 28, is hewn down, and then it comes off the next page on line 5, cast out devils, and heal the sick. So you have a wonderful tone of soul as truth. Soul as truth that through rebuke is bringing out truth, namely, the destruction of error. Yeah? So in a way we can say that the reproof and the rebuke is soul as truth.